This podcast is brought to you by the new October term at fxphd.com. Once again, we've tried to make a special effort to deliver on the requests of our members, offering new courses in Nuke Studio, Golem Crowds, V-Ray version 3, and even special access to the upcoming learning editions of Flare and Flame Assist on OS X. Check it all out at fxphd.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
All right.
I was wondering if I could start in your early days.
Okay.
I guess there's a tremendous interest in your, you had a naval career and then a photographic career. And I guess I wanted to start there because one of the pieces of advice I hear quite often, and I get your perspective on this, is that using a stills camera is one of the greatest training tools for visual effects.
Well, if we go back further than the Navy to my high school, I had a great photo teacher in high school who was like a, he was like a real geek and real super nerd. He taught physics and photography. And so basically I learned the nuts and bolts of photography, including, you know, we had to mix our own chemicals. We learned optics. We learned film structure and all the behind the scenes aspects of photography and so by the time I got out of high school, I was the editor of the photo of the
like the yearbook or the
yearbooks, right? So I was the yearbook photographer, and I also shot for the LA Examiner, the Scholastic Sports Association, and I had a 4x5 press camera. It was a Crown Graphic. Not a speed. I was always lusting after a speed graphic because you got a thousandth of a second. But actually, the limitation made me a better photographer because I had to learn how to shoot at the peak of action, and usually the peak of action is where the best shot is happening anyway. Because if you didn't shoot at the peak of action, it would be a blur. But if you get it right at the crest, so anyhow. I was like Ouija. I had a pack of flash bulbs in my pocket and a couple of 4x5 film holders, which you need two sheets, one on each side of the holder.
Which must have led to an enormous discipline because you just don't get to, like you do in the modern age, just fire off 100 shots and then see what works.
Well, the thing, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you slam cut to 2014, where you now know you no longer are limited by the 36 exposure roll, and you have like 2,000 photographs on your card, you get kind of sloppy. And I think that happens to a lot of filmmakers too, because I mean I think filmmakers of today tend to leave the camera rolling, and then which means that they have to look through all that footage, you know, which is a waste of time, you know, and so they don't have the discipline of cuts, like Hitchcock would shoot.
To the board, right?
He would shoot to the sentence, and then he would cut. You know, I mean, he didn't do coverage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But before we get to that, because I'm just intrigued. No, it's just that, you know, you're a rock and roll photographer. And
I was.
If I didn't have enough admiration for 15 other things you've done, I thought it was great you did rock and roll.
Well, I can get to that in a minute. That comes after the Navy, and that comes. Basically, then I was living in Monterey Park, which is kind of a boring place, and it's in a suburb of Los Angeles. And a friend of mine and I, we were shooting for the LA Examiner. We were supposed to be on a cruiser, shooting pictures of the grip and grin photos of the captain, you know, saying hi to everybody.
Right.
And instead, we wound up going. We saw this destroyer, which looked more fun, and so we got on that, and they were asking you how you wanted your eggs, you know, and all that kind of, you know, when you were getting the chow line. And, I mean, unlike when you actually get in the Navy, they ask you how you want your eggs that are already on the spatula, right? But anyway, it was a day in the Navy that the Navy put on. And,
right.
And basically we were there to cover it. And, we were both knocked out by the idea of joining the Navy, and basically within 2 weeks, I joined the Navy, and
yeah, as I said, my father was career Navy.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous, tremendous honor, obviously, to serve for one's country, but it's also, I think, you know, obviously, I'm a bit biased, one of the best of the armed services.
Well, it was also a lucky time because, I mean, when I went, when I graduated from high school, I joined the Navy, and because I had graduated from high school, I could actually go into this HSAR program they had. And that meant that if you had that meant they had to guarantee your school.
Right.
In other words, they weren't going to stick me into bosun's mate and, you know, be swabbing the decks. So I went in as a photographer, and I spent like, you know, 6-8 maybe 3 months in Norman, Oklahoma at a prep school.
Well, I was going to say, but isn't there a sunburn that played a big part in this story?
Oh, right. So I was actually a very, very accomplished photographer by the time I joined the Navy. And so when I was in photo school, I was phoning it in because I knew all that stuff. And it was interesting that I didn't know aerial photography, but I mean, that was not that much heavy lifting thing. One day I went to the swimming pool at the base in Pensacola, Florida, and I fell asleep on my stomach, and I got a terrific sunburn. I had the
blisters.
And I went to the PA or the infirmary to get help. And the guy said, "Well, I can give you something." He says, "But I'll have to put you on report because that's derelict of duty." In other words, that you can be shot for that in wartime, because you're Navy property and you're abusing just, Navy property here.
Self-abuse. Yeah. Okay.
So I went to the base PX and got some stuff and put it on there. But I mean, it wasn't that much of a help. But there was a warrant officer that was actually a really, really nice guy, and he saw that I was a serious photographer and all that, and so basically he kind of took me under his wing and let me sit in his office and read the Ansel Adams books and other advanced photography books while I was recuperating, because it took me like literally about a minute to stand up. If I stood up too fast, I'd faint. So anyway, later when the orders came for where you're going to be stationed, I didn't want to be stationed at Corpus Christi, Texas for 2 years, you know, so I put in for a carrier, and they're saying, "You're out of your mind, you know, a carrier, man, that's, you know," and I said, "Well, hey, I'll be traveling, you know," and so basically the orders came in, and I wound up with shore duty in Atsugi, Japan.
Wow.
1960, which was like, this was like paradise.
Yeah. I mean,
first of all, it's a fantastic culture. And secondly, I was making like, I started making like $90 every 2 weeks. And then I made third class and I was making $140. And then I made second class, I was making $205 every payday. But I mean, I could go to Tokyo and stay in the finest hotel. I stayed in the Frank Lloyd Wright Imperial Hotel for like $5 a night.
Because it would have been a very different time. And of course, Japan is an incredible, I mean, today, still incredibly interesting culture, but then so much different to what you would have been having here in the States.
Well, I took very much of an interest in the culture, and I study Japanese, so I still speak a little Japanese.
Yeah, you have a tremendous affinity with the sort of entire Japanese
and you
culture.
You see, my office is full of Japanese prints. I have a collection of Japanese prints and Japanese art. My wife is fluent. She grew up in Tokyo, but she's not Japanese. She was Russian Jew refugee. Anyhow, so the Navy was very good to me, and basically when I got to Atsugi, at one point I went into the hot locker, basically, which is a place where they store the cameras, and there was a brand new 16mm Mitchell camera that had never been opened, that had been ordered by someone, and then by the time it got there, that guy had been,
all right, okay,
you know, had yeah, moved on. And so I took this camera out, and you were encouraged to learn and to experiment. And so basically, two other guys and I put together a documentary team, and we come shot a Navy station wagon and all these kind of things around different places around the base. Amazing what an 8x10 glossy will get you. And I mean, the photo lab was about, there were about 40 of us in the lab, and there were there was one guy who was a full-blooded Cherokee, who was the only jarhead, I mean the only Marine in the base, in, or I mean in the group. And he said, "Edlin, you don't need to go to Brooks Institute. You want to go to USC because they got the cinema school there, you know." And so basically I said, "Oh, that's interesting." So I sent a letter to USC and got all the information. And my parents could actually afford to send me to USC. I mean, it was only like $600 a term at that time. And if you paid $600 a term, you could take as many units as you wanted. And so I was taking like a completely full unit, so I could do basically 3 years in two.
Is this when the rock photography started?
No, this is before.
Okay.
So anyway, I went to USC for 2 years and did all these classes, and then I got out.
So this is going to be mid-60s, right?
This would have been 63.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. And so in 63, I decided that instead of being transferred to this was at night, by the way. I was going to night school.
Oh, okay.
Because my high school grades were, you know, if I liked the class, I'd get an A or a B, and if I didn't, I'd get a C or D, you know. So I had to take a few classes over in order to even get into USC and take it and do night school. So basically I had almost a straight A average. I had one B, and so I could have transferred to day school, but then my parents would have to pay even more, and I thought, well, hey, I'm going to just get a job, because I mean I don't need any more schooling. And basically, you know, I learned a lot about the gestalt of the business while I was going to SC, because there were kids that were my classmates who were relatives of, they had relatives in the business. And so basically one of my good friends, his father was an assistant director. And
it's an industry town in LA.
Yeah. And so basically I got to know what kind of, how the business worked, you know, the politics of the business. And so I basically put in a resume into the Department of Employment in Hollywood and bloodied my knuckles and got the old, "You're in the union?" "No." "Well, then we can't hire you." And then you go to the union. I say, "Can I get in the union?" "No, you have to have a job." And, you know, it's like one can't hire the other. So, but anyway, the resume that I left the Department of Employment found its way to Joe Westheimer, who had a company who did titles, opticals, inserts, and you know, various types of shots, special effects shots for commercials, things like that, and for TV shows. And so I went over to, and Joe called me, and I went over to meet him, and we, and about 25 minutes later, he offered me the job.
So now maybe I've got my chronology wrong. So was this the period where you literally featured in the Addams Family?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to tell that story? Because I'm stunned by that.
See, the thing is, we shot inserts for a lot of TV shows.
Like Beverly Hillbillies, right?
Beverly Hillbillies. Let's see. The ones that I remember most. I mean, some of them were just holding up newspapers and stuff like that.
But like Wild Wild West.
But
I think
Wild
was
Wild West was fun. We had a lot of weird inserts to do on that. And then we did Star Trek with the original.
Okay, so rumor has it.
Because I was relatively dexterous, I wound up being the hand for Thing in the inserts. I'd be under the table and...
It's your hand in the credits, right? In the opening title sequence.
In the main title, yeah, is my hand.
But you skipped over Star Trek, because I want to get back to that.
It's also, you know, in a lot of the shots. I mean, shifting cars and lighting cigarettes and making, you know...
Hand gestures. Hand acting.
You know, hand gestures, right. And then... Star Trek, first of all, besides beaming them up, which we do after lunch, that was like pretty straightforward. It was like a single frame rotoscope, and then I would shoot like reflections from mercury and various optical, you know, elements in order to make them look kind of, gossamer and twinkly. But Lynn Dunn, who was like the patron saint of visual effects, who actually did the effects for the original King Kong, was one of the houses. There were like four houses that were doing shots for Star Trek. And we were one, and Frank Vanderveer and Film Effects, and I think Modern did some stuff. Anyway, so Lynn did the shot of the Enterprise flyby, but the model was like really big, and so basically when the model got close to the camera, the screen wasn't big enough to cover it, so it went off the blue screen. So I wound up with the job of rotoscoping the model. I had to rotoscope the model, as it was just holding out stars anyway. It wasn't that big a deal, but also the pylon that held it up.
It's kind of ironic. It's not like we ever have anyone shooting off a screen these days.
I know. Well, blue screen was like, see, the thing is, back in those days, and that was when we first started experimenting with blue screen, and Joe and I, and I basically would, we would shoot a wedge for the mat and then send it to the lab. And as soon as it got, and I would be waiting for it to come off the lab, and so I could get back. And so we would then pick the exposure and then shoot the mat so the soup wouldn't change.
Right.
And get it back, you know, because otherwise if you wait too long, then the chemical would change and the mat would be too big or something.
It's just remarkable, that chemical process in terms of
it was like photomasochism, you know. And it was actually, it got worse at Abel's. That was some time later, but in any case, and then after, I moved Joe to a new studio. We moved, and I was like the guy that did it. I did sweeping up, and I did picking up the titles and running, making film runs to the labs, hand lettering titles, shooting inserts, shooting titles.
Because titles literally were like on a card.
They were on a card, yeah.
You had to actually make them up.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I hand lettered a lot of titles. Yeah. I did Big Valley, and I did Patty Duke and Burke's Law and a bunch of main title shows.
So this is what I don't understand, because you'd think you'd go from Star Trek to Star Wars in a pretty quick jump, but the whole rock photography thing, we haven't covered that yet.
Yeah, no. So anyway, around this time, a friend of mine and I, we were listening to Egon shoot Stravinsky and smoking a joint. and so basically my hair started growing long, and I was listening to Bob Dylan and various other guys. And I had, meanwhile, I'm cruising around in my Cadillac Eldorado, because I had my girlfriend was actually Dear Abby's daughter at the time. And
okay.
I wound up buying her mother's car.
Right.
Which she'd change every 2 years.
Okay.
So I had this really bitchin' Eldorado. But anyway, and basically then I sold the Eldorado and started riding a bike, and you know, went in this whole ego, let's get rid of the ego problems kind of thing. And,
Mother Earth.
And I was actually sitting in Zazen with a Zen Roshi.
Okay, so we're now at the end of the 60s, I'm presuming.
We're at 67, 67, 68.
Yep.
And then a friend of mine, before I actually gave Joe the notice, I gave him 3 months' notice, actually. And I wound up shooting a photo session for a friend of mine who I had gone to high school with. He was a drummer, and they were playing a lounge act on this cruise boat that was like dried. It was basically docked at San Pedro, and it was like one of these cruisers that would cruise the coastline from San Diego to Alaska, and it was decommissioned, but they had, it was a cool place to have a dinner, and he, so he played that, and it was also a cool place to photograph, because I mean you get on one of these old, you know, iron yeah. ships, and there's like infinite compositional possibilities. And so I basically did a real good photo session of his group. And it turned out that his agent was in the same office as the guy that was managing the Fifth Dimension.
Okay.
And so the guy that was with the Fifth Dimension saw these pictures and says, "Who is this guy? I want him to shoot my group." Mark Gordon. And so my second job was to go to fly to Las Vegas and shoot an album cover and a bunch of posters for the Fifth Dimension.
Okay.
And so I sold my old Leica and my Rolly to this guy named Lloyd, who had a camera. He was kind of a shark, a camera shark, had a store on Cahuenga. And I had to get another camera body, because I only had one camera and one lens that I shot the other deal with. But I had to have wide angle lenses and telephoto lens. So I got all that equipment together real quick and flew off to Vegas and shot the Stone Soul Picnic album cover. And then I did a lot recording sessions and things like that. And then I did, Warren Zevon became a friend of mine, and I did his first cover and his second cover, which was never published. Anyhow, and I did the Grassroots and Seals and Crofts and.
So you're doing this for like about 4 years, if I'm not mistaken. You like mm-hmm. You did it for several years.
Let's see. It would have been 67, 68, 69, 68, 69, 70, 71. Yeah, it was like 3.5 years probably.
And then you get at Robert Abels, is that right?
Well, then I decided, then basically my daughter, in 1970, my daughter was born. And in 71... she's like rubbing her eyes and they were pink from the smog. I mean, the smog was so bad in LA at that time. And I said, let me get the hell out of here. And besides that, what had happened was it was no longer the Marijuana Brotherhood, but cocaine was starting to permeate the business, you know. So I decided to move up to Garberville. And I spent the summer in Garberville, which is about 200 miles north of San Francisco. And I figured at the end of that summer, I would figure out what was happening. And basically, during that time, my marriage fell apart. And so I wound up moving back to San Francisco and living underneath a friend of mine's house. He had an apartment under his house in the Presidio area. Really nice. And he was like an ex-beatnik. And he had invented the light show, basically.
Okay.
And he used to do light shows with some saxophone player down in North Beach in the 50s. But he was very good with playing with liquid projections. And so I did a film with him with liquid projections only called Stepping Stones. And then we did another one called Za. And then another one called Lapis Lazuli. There were three movies. And these were like very strange, kind of dark, esoteric, metaphysical,
experimental,
yeah, with dancers. I mean, Diane Varsi was in Za, and I remember I did a whole scene with her on the beach up near Big Sur, and her costume was made out of kelp, and I was shooting with infrared film.
Wow!
And so the kelp became this vibrant red, and she was damn near naked, you know. But I mean, it was an interesting film, but anyway. So I was doing these experimental films with Elias, and driving cable cars, the ones that you could drive, you know.
Yeah.
And I was giving tours of San Francisco, and then shuttling doctors and computer guys from IBM around different conventions. And I decided I was going to do this. This was my year sabbatical.
Okay.
And so. And meanwhile, to back up a little bit, I had come up with this amplifier, the Pignose, right?
Pignose amplifier.
And that was while I was shooting, because I had this friend called Mike Daisy, who was like an incredible guitar player. I mean, this guy, I mean, he had this funky looking Stratocaster. The frets were like, he'd been playing the frets and they were like, they had little hooks in them. I mean, he was an incredible guitar player. And then Larry Osborne was on the bass, Joe Osborne on bass. Larry Nechtel on the piano, Jim Horn on the woodwinds, and Hal Blaine on the drums. And this rhythm section did all of the Monkees, you know, all these groups Session that couldn't really play.
Yeah.
I mean, they would play, but
the Monkees
sucked,
were
you know.
Formed for television, yeah.
So anyway, I decided to get a guitar and play a guitar. And so one day I was at Pacific Radio, this electronic shop, because I was always making stuff. And I saw this amplifier that was like the size of a Marlboro pack. And I thought, practice amp. I can make a practice amp for my guitar with this. You know, so I bought the thing, the amp, and I went over and picked a speaker that looked kind of cool and got a potentiometer and a battery pack and a jack. And that went and basically went home and I made a case that had, you know, put it in a guitar case. And then later I decided, oh, this is a little cumbersome. So I put it in an English leather box. And then the pig nose concept came up. And then Warren was doing his second album and he was blowing out all the other recording scenes with his Marshalls turned up to 11 in order to get the feedback. But you could get feedback with the pig nose that sounded even better, and you could play it at reasonable volume where you didn't have to have earplugs.
But we've got a pig nose just here. Yeah.
Original one with the rubber nose.
Can we just, as an edit point, can you just,
yeah.
Is that all right?
Shot of the pig nose.
Yeah, we'll get that after. Go ahead.
Okay.
So anyway, that was the birth of the pig nose. And so I was up in San Francisco coming around to my 1 year anniversary, and I decided, okay, so I rented a studio over on Bryant Street, and I didn't really know what I was going to do yet, but I was moving my stuff into the studio, and Wayne Kimball down in LA called me and says, I got one on the line. Jimmy Gersio's going to fund us, and we're going to develop the pig nose amp as a production item. And Jimmy he was the producer of Chicago. So
right.
Chicago was basically, and Terry Kath and all those guys. And so basically, I had originally, when I came up with the idea, had built 65 of those. Okay.
By hand.
And we gave them to all the rock stars. I mean, we were able to get them, to Mick Taylor and Keith Richards and Frank Zappa loved them. And George Harrison. I mean, we got them to all the top guitar players. So those were out in the business. And so when we came out with our production model, it was the legendary pig nose already.
Right.
It only took a year to create the legend, though.
Yeah. The world's
best
guitarists.
You know, yeah. So I mean, it was $89.95, and we built. While I was there, we built. I don't know how many thousand, several thousand in the first year. And we had a production line out in the valley. These women were making them. And there was this kind of hippie that later became a Coke dealer, was the quality control guy. And he would check them all out and make sure they all sounded good. And so, yeah. So anyway, that was the pig nose. And I spent a year on pig nose, and After a year, I thought, you know what, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be making guitar amps. I mean, first of all, Pignose Industries was the company. And when you'd call and order something from Pignose Industries, they never forgot the name. And so, but anyway, we were going to do, you know, like carry bags and whatever types of things, you know, with a pig nose logo. And I actually designed the logo for that, did the lettering on that.
So how do you get from amps to Robert Ables?
Well, So Wayne and I, Wayne is a graphic designer, and Wayne and I were partners doing album covers.
Right.
I did Three Dog Night, you know, those kind of covers. And so we, so basically, and then through Wayne, I met this guy, Richard Taylor, who was also into light shows, but he was a graphic artist, and he knew Bob Abel and introduced me to Bob Abel. So I started shooting time-lapse clouds for the bicentennial.
Okay.
And so I started shooting time-lapse clouds with a Mitchell that I had bought and rebuilt. It was a military one. I took it all down, all apart, and rebuilt it. And so I started shooting there was one other cinematographer there. It was Dave Stewart, great guy. He passed away about 10 years ago now. Young guy. Anyway, I was the one that was shooting the Clairol commercials where the girl would be swinging her hair and with my high speed camera, and I came up with a look, which was the candy apple neon look that Bob called it.
Okay.
And it was basically animated graphics, and Richard would do graphics, and I did some too. I did the Sunbeam commercial and a couple of other things, but the main thing that we did was the Uncola commercial and the 7-Up butterfly girl, which got Bob Cleo's.
Right. Yeah.
And so they were like famous, really hot commercials in 75. And so we were doing, and then from that we did all of the station breaks for ABC.
The streaking. The streaking, yeah.
Nights of the Movies, all those, you know, Eyewitness News, all those different shows. And because Bob would always overspend, we'd have to shoot Eyewitness Baltimore and Eyewitness, you know, Atlanta, you know. And it was kind of boring to do that because you're in a sensory deprivation chamber for like 12 hours, you know, to do the shot. And you're
just give us an insight on what it took to do that, because if people don't know that technique that you were using in that stage.
Well, first of all, it's all multiple pass photography. And there's a guy named Dave Holland and Ray Feeney were like young. I think Holland was like a senior at Caltech, and Ray Feeney was like a freshman or a sophomore. And those guys were building this digital memory system that enabled us to come up with programs on punch tape, which we did on a Western Union.
Wow.
You know, it was like a Western Union keyboard.
I mean, it's one thing to not get a series of commands incorrect. It's another to not get a series of commands incorrect when you have to type them in a machine that literally punches through cardboard, make sure the little bits at the back are all taken off.
Right, and there's no hanging chads.
Yeah.
And then there's no dust in the print, in the reader.
And then it all just like loads properly.
A nightmare. I mean, it was like,
how you ever got anything
and
done?
You're like, did I shoot that fucking frame? You know, I mean, and then you're thinking, oh God, now I got to come back tomorrow night and shoot it again, you know? So that's, you know, that was the photomasochism. And there would be like 80 passes or more to a shot that's less than 3 seconds long. You know, this was like one shot from the commercial.
Yeah. Talk about pre-production planning though. You weren't winging it in those days.
Yeah. Well, you had regular animation count sheets that were usually like this wide and that long, but we'd have like five of them taped together because it was so many passes.
And it's from Robert Abels that you get the now famous phone call to come and work on a...
Well, then, you know, the thing is that we all kind of knew about each other. I mean, we knew that Douglas was shooting stuff out in the valley, and John Dykstra was working with him, and Dick Alexander was the machinist at Abels, and he had no, and Bruce Logan was a guy. Bruce came on, he shot the Death Star exploder with a high-speed camera that we set up.
So I hear you had a pretty serious counteroffer to stay at Robert Abels, didn't you?
Well, Bob, what happened was I gave Bob a long notice also. I said, Bob, another one of those three-month notice things. I said, I'm gonna leave Bob. I'm going to do this sci-fi movie. And I was making like about $350 or something like that a week at that time. And I kept getting these $50 a week raises, you know. And so by the time I was leaving, I was making $750 a week. And I was going to only make $600 a week starting on Star Wars.
Well, thank
so I had
Lord
to take
did.
The dock and pay.
Yeah, thank the Lord you did.
But it was the best decision I ever made in my life.
Well, yeah.
And that was John Dykstra
that got you over, right? Mm-hmm. It's John Dykstra that got you over at that point?
Well, John was the supervisor.
Yeah.
And basically, I met with John and Gary Kurtz, and we talked about how we would do this. And we hit it off real well.
Give me some insight into the mindset, like even on that early Star Trek stuff, but on this Star Wars stuff. So we are completely before these become the iconic, legendary things that they are today. What was the view? I'm not talking about the plot now, but what was the view of the effects work you were doing? Did it seem experimental? Did it seem like it was an extension of what you'd been doing?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, our idea was, first of all, to make a miniature camera that would shoot miniatures in the same way, so something that was shot with this system would look the same way it would look if it would be shot with a guy with a handheld Aeroflex,
right?
You know, and so knowing that as you're panning, you're doing a swish pan as this plane, you know, I mean, the background is blurring like crazy, and if you were to try to shoot this stop motion, in other words, shoot a frame, move it, shoot a frame, move it, shoot a frame, move it, which was the old way to do it, it would have juddered.
Yeah.
And it was like the Harryhausen movies, yeah. You know, they, you know, the wings are flopping around, you know.
Which means that this computer technology that you'd sort of, I hesitate to use the word computer technology because it evokes the wrong image, but this sort of computerized motion.
Well, basically, what we could do now is we could, because the camera could move to make the same, in other words, every time the camera shutter opened, the camera was still moving. And so there would be blur.
Yep.
And the camera, and I had designed this Trojan helmet head that put the head moved here, but the, it didn't, in other words, if you were to do a tilt like that, the lens would sweep.
Right.
But if you do the tilt like this.
So a nodal pan around the lens.
So it's basically nodal around the, so it's a nodal point head.
Right.
So the pan and the tilt were, and the roll were all on the nodal point.
Right.
Or very close to it. And so basically that was the system. And then I slung the camera from the top so that we could basically, oftentimes I would shoot shots upside down.
Yeah.
Or sideways even. Yeah. I mean, using gravity to our effect.
I mean, as a kid, I saw you in documentaries doing that stuff, and it really seemed genius. I mean, it seemed incredibly inventive as well as hard work.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, that was one of the tipping points of Star Wars was that my theory is that there were four tipping points. One was hiring Ralph McQuarrie. To do the design, and he basically art directed the entire series. Two was hiring us to do the effects because we were the only ones at that time that really had the chops to do that. Three was Johnny Williams, music, and
yeah.
Four, and maybe one of the most important, was Alec Guinness. The casting of Alec Guinness. Once I heard George had cast Alec Guinness, because I was worried because I thought the movie was kind of a teenage script. And, you know, trust in the Force, Luke, you know, you weren't going to see Lauren Green pulling those kind of lines off. You know what I mean? I was like, who could pull those lines off besides Brando? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And make it play that had the gravitas. But when he hired Alec Guinness, I knew that Jaws was in trouble.
Let me ask you this, because we're in an era that most people think as ILM, but it wasn't ILM because you disbanded effectively at the end of Star Wars, didn't you?
No, well, ILM was actually, that was the name of the company that we started.
But But I, okay, so maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that when you did the first Star Wars, it wasn't like an ongoing company that was going to continue doing effects.
It wasn't exactly. Right. It wasn't exactly. I mean, basically what happened was we did Star Wars, and it was such a monstrous success that it was obvious that there had to be a sequel. And so George went into writing the sequel. And while he was doing that, we converted the system over to 4PERF and did Battlestar Galactica, the three-part, two-hour miniseries.
So you say 4PERF as in you're now running the film horizontally through the gate so you can get greater film area?
Well, we did an 8PERF. That was VistaVision. And so we used VistaVision on Star Wars.
Yeah, because that gave you the step-down quality that maintained exactly. 35 at the still.
And
right
basically,
level.
I had discovered... Howard Anderson was a friend that I had met through the ASC, and he and his father was, you know, used to do all the inserts at Paramount, and then Howard Anderson Jr. wound up doing what his father did, and now Howard Anderson III is now also in the effects. But anyway, so Howard had this big insert stage at Paramount. And upstairs of the insert, you'd go up this long stairway. There was a hallway, and along the hallway, you'd go into this room, and there is a you turn the knob to turn the light on, because it's like 20s technology. But the Anderson printer, what we call the Anderson printer, was in there.
Yep.
And the last camera report to be shot on the Ten Commandments was in there. Because that was the last time that the printer had been used. And they just shot that and sent it to the lab and never went back in there.
Closed the door, yeah.
You know, and so basically I found that when I was at Abel's and I was trying to talk to Bob. I said, he'll sell that whole system for like $14,000. He would sell the printer for $10,000. And then for another $4,000, we'd get extra cameras and rotobenches and it would be this fantastic system, and we wouldn't have to shoot everything. We would be able to, you know, do composites, and we wouldn't have to shoot everything first generation, which was the trick in the Candy Apple.
I don't want to jump to today, but today you are obviously very much associated with the Academy. I'm just wondering if you can, just amplify for me, when Star Wars is acknowledged by the Academy in 77, 78, at the next Academy Awards that came around, you effectively win an Oscar, but it's not actually awarded as an Oscar because of the nature of where the visual effects industry was at that time.
No, it was an Oscar. It was not. We were nominated.
I thought you got a special Oscar that year.
That was Empire and Jedi.
Ah, okay. I apologize.
So Star Wars, we got nominated, and our competition was Close Encounters.
Yep.
And in fact, when we were there at the Oscars. And we're seated, and John is like grinding his teeth. You know, he's like so, he's really, you know, keyed up. And I said, John, I said, relax. We're sitting next to the aisle. You know, we got it. You know,
is that a tip for today?
Well, you know, they don't actually. I mean, the Academy wouldn't actually look and see because they can't tell, but they can handicap.
Okay.
And I mean, so Star Wars was such an, I mean, people were like, if you went to a party and you hadn't seen Star Wars five or six times, you apologized.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was like that kind of a social.
So why is it that when the Academy honors the next films, you're not just getting, again, an Oscar? Why is that different?
Well, we got an Oscar.
Well, I'm sorry, you did,
but it was a special achievement award because there was no competition.
Okay, so
I mean, it's like there's like no contest. So I mean, it was like The Empire Strikes Back was so far ahead of any other movie that was out that year that it just became a special award.
Right. So in other words, the Academy fully appreciated the value of the film.
Right.
But it just, unlike today, had no sort of viable competition.
Correct.
And that happened again the following for the third film.
Well, actually, after Star Wars, I did Galactica, and then I did Star Wars, I did Empire Strikes Back. After Empire Strikes Back, I immediately went into Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Which, again,
I won an Oscar. Yeah. I was like 3 for 3.
Yeah.
And then after that, I did Poltergeist, which should have won the Oscar, but E.T. won that year. But yeah. I mean, Poltergeist was much more complex and much more difficult show than E.T. was. But yeah. E.T. was another.
Another phenomenon.
Phenomenon.
But let's go back then, because in all of this going on, there's also SciTech Awards.
Right.
And I really want to focus on those, because when you've done interviews in the past, people tend to skip over the SciTechs, which I think is a terrible shame. And you don't ever get a chance to articulate the technology that was rewarded by those SciTechs. I was wondering if I could bother you to do that now.
Well, we had, some years, I can't remember the years, but it would have been in the 90s, probably. 91, 92, somewhere in there. We gave several Oscars to motion control. The SciTech committee took up motion control as a study, and we figured that these five people were the ones that should be awarded. And Al Miller and Jerry Jeffers. Yeah, from the Star Wars, because those guys, Al Miller and Jerry Jeffers, were nuclear physicists, and they were working up in Berkeley or up there in Oakland. Where is it?
I was going to say Los Alamos. That's not right.
Not Los Alamos. I forgot the name of the lab. But they were working up in that area. They had on high level nuclear physics projects. And John met them on some movie, and so they started talking about motion control and how to build a motion control system. And they were both like electronics nuts. Basically, the reason motion control came about was largely because of digital technology and digital clocks, the clocks that would be repeatable to infinite, millionths anyway, and the stepper motor.
Yes.
And so the stepping motor, which was a motor that actually was driven by square wave. And basically, you would get 200 square wave steps per revolution, and so basically you could repeat, the motion exactly, and so the original system was built to handle like the 200 stepper, and the thing is that 200 steps per revolution is pretty rough, and so we had these rubber
like gears.
No, it's like a shaft. The shaft would be here, and then there'd be a hard rubber thing that would absorb the shock.
Okay.
And reasonably well would be repeatable, and so we used that, and that helped a lot. But then Jerry came up with the microstep, and he came up with the microstep system, which instead of 200 steps per revolution square wave, it was like 3,200 steps sine wave. So each step had a
more of a rise and fall.
It was a sine wave as opposed to a hammer hit.
Yep.
So it had a rise and fall. So that system, which of course nobody had time to patent, was quickly ripped off by the CNC business. I mean, they realized what we had done, and so they copied that. But anyway, so that was a big deal. And I mean, the technology that we agreed on when I first started meeting with John, he was talking about doing it what they call front light backlight. In other words, you do one pass with a beauty lighting, and then you turn off that light, and then you shoot it against black, and then the next pass you put a white screen behind the model, and then don't light the model,
and it becomes its own mat.
However, lots of reflection comes from the white screen, as well as the fact that the white the model moving against a white background will not give you the same amount, the same kind of blur that you would get from the actual shot. And so I argued that that wasn't going to work for the movie, and that would be much better to shoot blue screen, because the matte would be obtained from the actual image. And so and so I won that argument, and I got the job, basically. I mean, that's one of the reasons, because he saw that I really understood the photographic process very well.
Okay, so I'm going to risk my total naivety and ask you, when I shot film, there was a lot more grain because of the structure of the film and the blue channel than the green. And so we would shoot green screen because we would basically get a cleaner matte with less noise. You guys were shooting blue on film stocks. What was I missing? Why was it? Was it just the content, or was it, because if you're shooting a spaceship, I don't see
why. Well, when
it
you're talking about film and compositing, I mean, the thing is that there, you know, the Petra Vlahos came up with the color difference matting system. You heard about that one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, basically that is a way of cajoling a synthetic blue separation from. You know, by manipulating of the mats and whatever. It's real complicated, and it makes my mind hurt.
We actually did a piece on the printer at ILM,
yeah,
and we replicated it in After Effects using only the techniques that you guys had,
yeah,
of subtracting and minusing effectively to get up. And it's complicated, but that process illuminated one thing to me. Why? I mean, it made it completely obvious why you want to go to VistaVision.
Well, I'll tell you, in a very simply, you can get a flesh tone, a good flesh tone, with just red and green. You don't really need blue to get a flesh tone.
Right. So that's just...
That's pretty much the reason.
Because there's an era when miniatures are going to be shot with red screens and...
I shot red screen.
Right, yeah. Narrower frequency spiked lights. Right.
On Air Force One, it was actually black light lighting a red screen.
You get a really narrow frequency, and and when you were doing Hoth, right? It's the problem with the white planet and the compositing.
Yeah, well, the thing is that on Star Wars, we were pretty much holding out against stars.
Yeah,
and there were some shots with matte lines. You know, I mean, some of the explosion shots had matte lines. And Robbie chose to use 5369 as the matting stock. And 5369 has a very, very steep contrast curve. And so, I mean, on Star Wars, it worked okay. But, I mean, you would be amazed to look at some of those frames and some of those shots that have a lot of blur in them. There are certain shots where you can't even tell what the image is. There's so much blur. But when you see the shot in action,
you buy it.
Yeah. And the other thing that's very interesting.
There's a lesson there, by the way, for people today.
Hmm?
I think there's a lesson there for people today of not being afraid of the not being able to read it on a single frame, but it works on a moving shot.
Right. Well, the thing is also, in the photochemical era, we were umbilically connected to the Geneva movement in the projector. In other words, the projector has a four cycle, the Geneva movement, the Geneva cross. And basically what happens when you see a frame of movie film is you see the frame flashed on the screen for a quarter of the cycle, then it goes black for a quarter of the cycle. Then it goes on again for a quarter of a cycle. And then it goes black while it gets pulled down to the next frame. So consequently, you're only seeing something half the time when you go and see a movie. You don't notice it because you get 48 flickers a second, and that's the flicker threshold for the human physiognomy. And so the difference now with digital projection, interestingly, just a side note, is that when you digitally project, the image is blanked out for microseconds, like 2 or 3 microseconds, and then you're back on again. So basically, you're seeing something for 98% of the time. And so consequently, you don't have this extra flicker which causes strobing.
Right.
Because, you know, because what happens is the brain expects the film, in other words, when, I'll explain it with when you shoot stars. Okay. When you shoot stars and the camera pans very quickly and you see the star field by itself, you see two stars.
For each star, you mean?
In other words, when you're watching the shot without any, without the shot composited, you see two stars because of that flicker, that it's the Phi effect, it's called. You don't get that when you shoot with a digital projector. You don't get that because you don't, it's not this 50 per, you know, it's not this blank.
Yeah. On, you know, just don't have to pull any film down into cycling. The projector.
So, but in Star Wars, you'd when we'd see the star field, you know, you'd see the star field, and they, not only would you see the two stars, but each star would be this long. You know what I mean? It would be like a tube. And you'd say, oh man. But then when you composite the ship in, your eye is watching the ship, and so basically you're not your brain is not physiologically connected to the stars anymore. It's watching so that becomes a peripheral effect.
So anyway, those snow composites.
Yeah. Back to the original question of the now we're on the snow planet, and so now we're
not against black.
We're not against black with stars. We now have to come up with a way of eliminating the matte line, and that was like a Herculean task in the photochemical era. I mean, it was just, I mean, for anybody to be able to make a composite without matte lines in those days was like arduous.
So the second, was that the first realization you get the script, hang on a second, this thing's all on snow and they've got walkers on it. Is that like the moment you just go, wait, excuse me, how are we going to do this?
No, we knew how we had to do it.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, the problem is now, instead of using 5369 for the mat, I came up with a dual mat system. I mean, basically, what we could do is we could come up with a mat that would fit the shot, and would not have a mat line, but it was transparent because the mat was not heavy enough to hold back the background through the mat. So what we had to do is we had to create a mat that perfectly fit, which was a lighter mat, and then we would make an undersized mat on 5302, which is film. It's a print stock.
Okay.
So we'd make an undersized mat on 5302, and we'd do that by using exposure to control the size of the mat, and bipack that with the edge mat, and then that was the secret. Every shot had to have a dual mat.
So this is Academy Award-winning work, so right. I take nothing away from it. But I'm right in saying that there are shots from inside the spaceship looking out where, in fact, if you'd looked at the original print in the cinema, and Lord knows I did but didn't notice it, the mats were a little bit soft, weren't they, on the side of the interior of the ship and stuff? Because you made the shot work is what I guess my point is. I mean, like it was like a different set of values that you had to kind of deal with. Because I know that when they went and restored it, they...
Well, here's one of the significant problems that we had was when they did the videotape of... When they did the video release of Empire Strikes Back, and Star Wars for that matter. Not so much of a problem on Star Wars, but it was more of a problem on Empire. Because when we had the garbage mats... The garbage mats would hold out all the, you know, all the stuff that you didn't, you know, wanted to garbage mat out, but it was like a block.
Hmm.
And we didn't care that they animated because the D-max on the print was enough to where you didn't see that.
Yeah, basically, it effectively crushed it out of being an issue.
Well, what happened is that in order to get good flesh tones, they relaxed the contrast.
Right.
And by relaxing that, we saw all those.
Yeah, it's incredibly unfair that your work gets seen in a way that wasn't intended and shows things that wouldn't have ever been.
But now we can fix all that with digital. You know,
absolutely.
Digital.
Before I leave this era, though, I just want to ask you one last question about Raiders, because it was remarkable in of its own right. I'm just wondering, what was the primary challenge presented there that was very different from what had preceded with Star Wars? Obviously, the locations are hugely different, but from a technical point of view, what was the thing?
I think the main difference was it wasn't a fantasy.
Right.
I mean, it was happening in 1930s America, you know, in the 1930s. And so so we couldn't get away with certain things we could get away with. I mean, you could get away with fill light in space in Star Wars, which we had to have in order to wash out blue spill. But, I mean, for example, I mean, there's a lot of other cheats that were possible. And actually the walkers themselves, because the walkers were stop motion, they were kind of juddering, but the thing is they were mechanical objects. And so that kind of worked for them.
Mm. You know,
and they weren't working so fast that it wasn't a big amount of move. So, but there was, it does strobe a little bit, but you buy it because it's a mechanical thing.
So there's a period then that you leave ILM for BOSS,
right,
and work on another collection of incredibly landmark pictures.
Well, let's not forget Poltergeist for a minute, because Poltergeist was actually the most difficult project for me of all of them, because that was happening next door.
Right.
I mean, that was your neighbor's house. And so consequently, whatever effect that we had to work in that kind of a context, and we couldn't get away with the kind of cheats that we could in Star Wars or those kind of movies.
And I'm thinking
or
that
even Raiders, because I mean Raiders was sort of fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was certainly action and the audience was along for the ride. I'm right in thinking that in the first Poltergeist you did some of the floating, drifty, wafty stuff as like underwater, right?
Yeah.
Which was tremendous. I remember once I heard that, I was like, I read Cinefix religiously.
Well, and then there was the hallway ghost. Remember the hallway ghost that was up top of the stairs? Well, we did that shot. The guys built the hallway ghost, but the damn thing was too big to fit in the hallway. And so basically I have what they call it is a Delrama lens from the Technoscope process, or not Technoscope, Technorama process, which is a 1.5-to-1 squeeze. So it has a 1.5-to-1, squeeze.
Yeah.
And I basically turned that lens on its side and squeezed the.
Okay, so you're literally using the optical characteristics of the lens to fit the
to fit this character into the hallway, and it was when we shot it in a cloud tank. So basically, here it is. There's the camera. Here's this lens. I'll show it to you. It's like these huge prisms with like inches of glass that the light is going through, and then there's like a 1-inch piece of glass in the front of the tank, and then there's water.
I think cloud tanks are the thing that I miss the most that we have no reason to shoot today, because the stuff that you guys got from shooting with those techniques, and I can't begin to imagine how hard it was to keep those tanks clean and shoot them.
Well, it was like, we had swimming pool filters.
But I mean, it was remarkable what you could get out of a cloud tank, apart from the obvious cloud things.
Right. And it's like, you remember the scene in Raiders where the clouds open up?
Yep.
That was a happy accident.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, basically, we had this big tube coming out of the bottom of the cloud tank, and we were draining the tank or something like that, and somebody kicked the tubes. Somebody stepped on the tube and caused a geyser of water to shoot up through the inversion layer and hit and it caused the clouds to, you know, and we said, hey, that's it. And that was a great thing to find out. I mean, that was a great shot. I mean, the lid of the arc was through the...
And those cloud shots added such production value. They really gave it a kind of, I mean, it's still to this day, I think effects artists that do effects animation provide tremendous production value to a film.
Right. Yeah. I mean, on Raiders, we had a lot of situations where we had to invent our way out of a corner, you know. And there's one shot, and there's two shots in Raiders I'll bring up that are pretty interesting that made it into the movie. One is when the ghost comes up to the camera, swims up to the camera, and there's this beautiful ghost, right? And all of a sudden turns into a skull.
As the arc lid has been taken off at the end of the film. Yep.
And this is when the ghosts are flying around and the Nazis are being surrounded.
And for a moment we think it's pretty, and this is
And then all of a sudden it becomes and basically in that shot, the second part of the shot, the skull is dropped down from the top, and it has there's a pipe.
Right.
And you can actually see the pipe if you're inclined to look away from the face,
which I wasn't, but yes.
And so that shot made it into the movie, and I mean that has a flaw. I mean that's something that could be fixed,
sure,
you know, like that today. But you know, we didn't have the digital. Know, we had to use Vaseline and seat of the pants methods to get out of problems like that. But there were, that was one. And then the other one is when there's a shot looking back toward the Nazis from next to the Ark. And the Nazis are getting zapped, I think, from the front.
It hits each of them and goes through to the next one?
Well, that's the rear shot.
Okay.
But then, anyway, we're looking back towards the Nazis. I think it may have even been before the Wrath of God started.
Yeah.
And basically, we have this composite, and I can't even remember what we were compositing in right now. But what somebody noticed was, hey, isn't that a camera crew over there? And what's funny about it is that another thing that's funny about it is, aside from the fact that we were on take five of the composite, and George had just approved the composite. And somebody said, hey, wait a minute, isn't there the camera crew over there? It's real dim. But sure enough, there's the airy, there's a pan airy, the Airflex pan airy, you know, and then the guy is in shooting back towards the, and the Nazis are filming the goings on with a Mitchell, with the Mickey Mouse ears. So we've got the cameras reversed. But, and George says, if we didn't notice it by now, it's going to be okay.
Okay.
So it went into the movie like that.
So I could talk all day just about Star Wars and Raiders for that matter, but I want to get on to Boss because you did tremendous work there.
Yeah.
Films like Die Hard. Well, what were your favorites from that period?
Well, Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
I mean, Ghostbusters was a real nightmare. I mean, it was like, first of all, putting the deal together was a nightmare with the studios, because basically we had the idea was that, first of all, we had to rebuild the studio. When I took the studio over from Doug, it was like a parts drawer. I mean, in other words, Doug's approach to visual effects is completely different than mine. He doesn't use blue screen, you know. He does matte paintings and stuff that way, and. We had a much more facile, I think, way of doing things, and we could do a lot more different kinds of shots. And but in any case, I had to rebuild the studio. But before that, we had to close the deal, and the deal was to do the visual effects in this new studio that we've taken over, and we're going to rebuild. But we're going to have to share the cost of building the optical printers, for example, with MGM and Columbia. So MGM and Columbia are going to have to co-fund the building of the studio, because we're going to do 2010, which is a November release, and Ghostbusters, which is a June release. So they're not competing with each other.
Right.
So that's a good thing. That's the beauty of it. But we still have to put these two studios together. And the lawyers think of every fucking thing imaginable. Sorry about the language. They think of everything imaginable. And it consequently, it took a long time to do the deal. And by the time we did the deal, by the time the ink dried on the contract, which in fact was never signed. Actually, I did sign it later. But we didn't sign it right away. But in any case, by the time we had gotten there, we only had 10 months to rebuild the studio, design all the effects, execute them,
wow.
and get them out. And so it was an incredible amount of work. And
what was the most difficult side of that? Is it the Slimer ghost type effects, or is it the big miniature-y stuff at the end with the rooftop sort of? Because, I mean, you needed a fair huge build for those.
I mean, all of it was difficult. I mean, I wouldn't say that any one thing was more difficult than another. I mean, the animation, the rubberized light, you know, that was the idea. It was, let's rubberize the light. So instead of having this shaft of light come out, we've got this weird.
Well, I've wanted to ask you my whole life, how do you did those rays coming out of the backpacks? Was it as simple as just?
Oh, you mean the light? You mean
when they're hosing the
guy down with this, yeah. With this? Yeah, well, that was animated.
Oh, it was animated.
Yeah,
okay.
So we had great animators animating that. Terry Wendell, John Bruno, those guys, and Sam Racinos and Anique Therrien. We had a really great crew, and I basically stole a lot of the people back that I'd hired from ILM. So that was like Dark Thursday. Up there, because I mean, a lot of the top notch people left to come with me.
There are a lot of good.
They were sitting on needles and pins for like a month because I had done first a deal with Ridley Scott to do Legends,
right?
And we had closed the deal. We were ready to go, and all of a sudden, Arnon Milchan pulled the plug because the budget was now $28 million, and he remembered that. The budget for Blade Runner, which was a tank. Blade Runner didn't make money. Blade Runner was a box office flop.
Yeah, only later did it become
the classic. But anyway, Blade Runner.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Blade Runner was budgeted at 22 and came in at 28.
Right.
And so he thought, well, if this one is budgeted at 28. Then it's going to come in at 38, and so he said, "No, we're going to shoot in England with we're going to use the Ugly Company, which is where you hire the dwarves and midgets." And we were actually planning. I mean, it was Mickey Rooney was going to be the troll,
right?
You know, and we were going to do it Darby O'Gill style with forced perspective.
Oh, really? That'd be interesting.
It was very interesting, and Ridley was really into that idea. It would have been fun to do that.
I read somewhere that,
but that
Multiplicity was one of your favorite films.
Yeah, it was.
Because that was a technical tour de force.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, the transition movie for us was Ghost.
Why is that? Why was that the transition film?
Well, because basically I'll tell you that story and then we'll tell you Multiplicity is a good one too. But Ghost was, first of all, Jerry Zucker, we had bid the project, but they wound up going to ILM for it, and they wound up with that sewer ghost or whatever. That was John Van Bleet, the black one that was
right.
animated. Anyway, and then so the end sequence they hadn't even started on, and Paula Schwartz, I can't remember who was the producer. Had let this one slip through the cracks, and they basically wound up within about 2 weeks before they were going to have a studio screening, and for the end sequence they had Pat Swayze walking up a Mylar ramp towards a blue screen, and there were actually grips scratching their ass in the shot. You know, I mean, they couldn't run this shot. For the screening. I mean, this is like the Unchained Melody. This is where the audience is leaving the theater with this uplifted thing.
Yeah.
And And so
walk to the light. Yeah.
Right. So
dramatic.
So I pitched, I went over there and I pitched the idea of doing the scene in digital video. And Walter Murch said, "Oh no, that's never going to work. I mean, the resolution's not going to happen." I said, "Well, we've got a real good I/O technique, how about letting us do a test?" And so we did. So they said, "Okay, let's." So they gave me work print. They didn't have IPs, you know, to do, and so basically gave me work print. I got some stuff that Gary Waller had shot. With an endoscope going through tinsel, you know, like Christmas tinsel on an animation stand. It was like this kind of very interesting animation that was going on. And so I had that element and a couple of other flare elements that we had in stock. And I went over to, let's see, what was it? Not PostLogic. Anyway, and Steve Price was the compositor. He's a really talented guy. And so working with Steve, we'd done commercials with him.
The Post
Group.
Post Group, yeah.
Yeah. So Steve, and he died, you know, I mean.
Yeah, Post Group, though, at that time was the go-to place.
Yeah.
But coming at it from TV, of course.
Right. So anyway, Steve and I put together, and we got Jerry, we put together an idea, and then Jerry came over and said, "Hey, that's working good, but let's do this and let's do that." And so I can't even remember if Jerry was involved in that. But anyway, we did the test, and this was on a Monday that I said, "Let's do a test." Well, on Friday, I said, "We're ready for a screening, you know, the test." So this was like 4 days later.
Yeah.
And, we basically did the composite in one day and maybe a little bit of the next day, and then they had to transfer the stuff and go to the lab, so we were ready to show it on Friday. And they were just dumbfounded because it looked great. And so basically I talked Howard Koch into doing the entire sequence, which was over 25 or more shots, in digital video with the work print. And so they could have the whole sequence, but it would cost about $45,000 to do this. And he said, "Well, that's throwing money away." And I said, "No, it's not really not throwing money away." I said, "Because in the process of doing that, we're going to find out what Jerry wants to see in the sequence, and it's going to save us infinite time when we do the final." And so I talked him, well, that was the logic, and I talked him into that, and he said, "Okay, I'll go for that." And so I went in with...
Kind of like post-viz, isn't it?
Yeah, and then we got Jerry involved, and Jerry was over there, and he'd come over for 2 hours, and then we'd work on it, and so we did the whole sequence, and then we showed the whole sequence to the studio executives, and they all thought it was final, because it looked good, and it was from work print, you know.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have had the contrast range in the work print, would you?
Well.
Not bad.
The hairy. I mean, we could manipulate, yeah. You know, and our guys had a really good I/O system, and then there was a shot of film kissing video where Pat Swayze comes in and he kisses her. She's a VistaVision element, which we actually had to, actually not that one, but we had to soften some of the VistaVision elements that we had converted to VistaVision to video because they were looking too crisp. So anyway, that sequence came out really well, and that was our kind of tipping moment, because I used to because we were doing commercials on the Harry, and that's where I met Helena Packer, who's my partner in our company at the moment. Anyway.
Before you said that was a crossover, because I'd asked you about Multiplicity. So yeah. I assume then you'd moved over to digital.
Yeah, Multiplicity was a project where it was interesting, because at the end of the project, I remembered making a statement earlier that if I ever do a show where I feel like it's perfect, it's time for me to retire. And I thought, well, I'm not really ready to retire, but Multiplicity is about perfect. You know, I mean, the shots work.
And, yeah.
And you can't tell. And the thing is funny also about that movie is when I went to see the when I went to see it in the theater when we'd finished it, I was with somebody who was a tech geek, and you know, he'd mentioned this or that for about 5 minutes, and then all of a sudden we just forgot about that and got into the movie and forgot about all the effects. But it was a very complicated project, and it required the full intellectual capacity of the group at BOSS.
I wouldn't normally ask about actors, but that's just something we don't tend to focus on. But it would seem to me that at this point in the process, Michael Keaton must have been very much sort of intellectually aware of the process as well, because it was a very, like, it's a difficult acting job to come up with not only the multiple roles, but the multiple eye lines, the to act.
It was not a difficulty at all. I'll tell
really.
You why. Because what we wanted to do is we wanted to make this as transparent to the crew as possible. And we had, when Michael would play the first scene there would be a key role. In other words, one of the shots, in other words, there would be one of the characters would be the key character to that shot. And that was, so we would shoot that shot with that character doing his lines to the one he's talking to, but the one he's talking to is got a video camera that's shooting him, and he's talking directly
so
to the lens of
in,
that camera.
You don't have a stand-in person. You have literally a camera standing where a stand-in.
No, we have a stand-in. In other words, there were four Michael roles.
Yep.
And there were four stand-ins.
So where's the camera?
Well, each stand-in had a character. In other words, one of the characters was the goofy one, one of them was the effeminate one, and one is the macho one, and then there's Michael, all right? And so basically, whichever part was the key role of that scene would be the first one we would shoot. And so basically the camera would shoot Michael and that other character, but the other character would be a stand-in over here.
Yeah.
But the stand-in would have a video camera, and Michael would be playing his part to the video camera.
Okay.
He'd be talking to that guy as the video camera. And so basically, and then offset, there was a guy who had a Miller Pro head that was pan and tilt, and we had indicators. And we had, what do you call them?
So like a geared head with a digital calibration?
Well, it had
a digital,
I can't remember what you call those things now, but it had
memory head.
It was a digital, it was a fluid head.
Yep.
With a rifle scope on top of it. One of those laser things.
Oh, okay. Yep.
And then it had optical, an encoder. It had an encoder on the pan and an encoder on the tilt. And basically, the guy offset would be following Michael's footprints, right? And so basically, if Michael was walking around talking to him, he's talking, pacing back and forth, this guy would be following his feet, you know, as he's walking. And then on the next shot, the stand-in would be
following the dot, effectively.
Right. In other words, the stand-in would be following the dot on the floor and holding a video monitor with the playback of the previous shot on it, so that the eye line was perfect. So he was always looking exactly at where he was, you know.
Right, and because the memory head is playing back the moving dot at the right speed, he's
right.
always getting to his mark, because his mark is effectively being updated.
Right, right. So basically we have a motion control input and a playback of the
dot. Michael finds it easy to keep his eye line, because all he has to do
have to worry about anything.
I either look at a camera or I look at the monitor of my
own
performance.
Right.
And I guess the monitor also gives him the audio cues, right?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Oh, he's wearing an off-camera hearing aid. So
right.
he's getting his dialogue, and so his timing is perfect. And it got hairy, because then in between this take, the first take and the second take, we had a trailer on the set that had Silicon Graphics workstations in it with guys who were doing composites. If we had pieces of blue screen in some cases, and sometimes they had to do a moving split, animated moving split, temporary. Yep. And then we would composite A to B, and then Harold would see A and B composited while he's shooting C. And it worked out great. And the stand-ins were really good actors. So they were real smart guys. And Michael was really a smart guy. And so, this was an interesting show that would never have been possible in the photochemical era.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like they're sitting on couches, you know, and the couch, bends down. And so we can deal with all that kind of stuff digitally. And when Michael is handing a sandwich to himself, he shoots this like this with his arm behind his back, and then the stand-in does the hand, and then we shoot the hand against blue screen, and then he hands himself the sandwich.
Right. So in fact, the hand that's handing over the sandwich, the hand that's receiving it, are in the same plate.
Right.
I'm looking, if I'm trying to be smart, at where the hand is to see. And you've done the magic trick up the sleeve.
Yeah. And we did that two or three times in the movie. And the thing is that we decided that we were not going to get into like doing ultra difficult composites. Like the shot that I think it was Sony Imageworks that we were competing with to get the job. And basically they did this complicated shot of throwing a beer can and the guy catching it and doing a digital beer can, and it just didn't work, you know. And so basically how we did it was Michael sitting on the couch and number two is on the couch, two is on the couch. And three is he's talking to, and he throws him a beer. And basically, so Michael throws the beer; it goes out of frame for like two frames, and then on the other shot, the stand-in throws the beer can to Michael, and Michael catches it, and it comes back in the frame. And it was, and we did two takes on it, and it was perfect. And Harold was just in stitches because he couldn't believe it was so easy to do.
Wow!
But it was because we had real talented actors, and we had
and a good process. Again, it sounds like really good pre-production.
Yeah, and we were having a lot of trouble because the at that time the technology of film was getting in our way because Kodak had come up with some dye coupler magic that interfered with the blue screen mats. And basically what would happen, for example, is if you had like a valley between, two, if you had like a sort of a V of the mat, it would fill in. And so we'd have to rotoscope this part.
Oh.
And it was just a phenomenon that was happening with the film, and so we had to fix that in a lot of shots. But that was something that we could handle because we had a really good roto group.
So after Boss, you go freelance and work on some great films, and effectively still are, though now you're in a company that's...
I'm kind of losing interest in New Orleans right now because... The problem is that there's no infrastructure down there.
Right.
There's like only like one. There's one guy that lives. He's a pretty good 3D guy that lives in Baton Rouge, but he's teaching and he's got a tattoo parlor and whatever. You know what I mean? And there's one guy that used to work at Digital Domain that lives there and he's a pretty good compositor. But there's not a workforce that we can depend on. So we have to import people, and that's expensive. So it's not been a real financial
Winning proposition.
Winning proposition, exactly.
But you're still actively working, because the reason I say that is that you today do so much work with the ASC,
right,
the Academy, and the VES. I'm kind of struggling to know how I could do that if I had nothing else on and and was, if you don't mind me saying so it's like slightly, you know, like if I was younger than I am today, I would find that hard to keep up the pace. You have a cracking work schedule.
It seems like it, but I mean, it's not that difficult. I am on three boards. I'm on the VES board, the ASC board, and the Academy board.
And all three of those organizations are the premier organizations for those industries.
Right. So, I mean, and I've been in the ASC since 81, and I've been on the board off and on for a good, like, two-thirds of that time, at least.
And just to amplify that, we talked earlier about the SciTech Awards.
Right.
Certainly that's where I saw you last,
right,
at the SciTechs. You have a very active role, not just like generally with the Academy, but with the SciTech Committee. And
right,
the SciTech Committee itself is so different to the non, sort of the acting side of the thing, because
right,
it involves investigation to
right,
validate. It's not a popularity or an expression of support from the general voting process
right,
that we're used to. It's a very detailed account of who has.
It is, but I mean, we have some really, really smart people, and the thing is, it's a volunteer situation, and with the volunteers, they spend ridiculous time on these projects. I mean, yes, I heard the group. You know, I mean, it's like there's about 50 engineers involved on the group, and we have a very, very good attendance rate. I mean, most people, people show up for the meetings. We only have a couple of meetings a year. We have two main committee meetings, and they were preceded by steering committee meetings. And then there's a couple of other along the way meetings.
Somebody's on that committee and contributing, and they have to fly in. I mean, they pay for that themselves. This really is a volunteer.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's a tremendous thing to volunteer for, but nevertheless, you are relying
right,
on very serious people giving up serious amounts of time.
Right, and we do have a reasonably good Skype situation set up. The last meeting, we had three people that were, at least one of them was, like, very important, you know, to be on the DITS committee. We have the Digital Imaging Technology Subcommittee. Now we have the Digital Apparatus Technology,
which is the new subcommittee.
That's a new one, but now we're dealing with the micromirror technology, the Texas Instruments, which is mind blowing.
Yeah,
technology. I mean, it's
could you just clarify for people what the difference is between the DITS, which has been established for some time, and this new apparatus? What qualifies as an apparatus?
Well, DITS is software, and DATS is hardware.
Right.
So we're talking about, you know, we've had a lot of software, and we continue to get a lot of software, and we're talking about rocket scientists. I mean, the thing is that the technology of the digital world is so complicated, and I mean, it's a completely different ingenuity involved than in the analog.
I could argue
world,
with you, you know, that while that's absolutely true, you said back in the day that it was nuclear physicists that were helping out.
Yeah.
And today there are lessons being learned in light transport algorithms from atomic
right,
transfer. So in a sense, there's crossover. But I'd like to suggest to you that one of the things that's incredibly important about the work that you and the Academy do in the SciTech area is that we have somewhat of a brain drain because of the share option kind of attraction of a Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach kind of thing. And the acknowledgement that the Academy gives for the engineers and the technicians that do develop these tools that allow
right,
the arts to flourish are incredibly important. But it's a very unique way of recognizing them that is really exclusive to our industry. And the technology to be rewarded has to be developed for our industry. It's not as if you give a SciTech award to someone who invented something for a different industry. We just happen to
hear. Well, that's right. I mean, that's like the Blahu's criteria, which is like the train headlight, you know. So the train has a headlight that you find out could be really useful on the soundstage, but it was really designed for the train, not for the movies. So anything that's not designed for the movies, I mean, LiDAR is a good example. I mean, LiDAR is a fantastic technology that's being used by the movies, but it was basically designed for the DOD, I think.
Yeah.
You know, to assess ship damage and things like that. I mean, there are many technologies. I mean, it's like, for example, another one that's difficult is the microphone. I mean, was the microphone designed for the movie industries, or was it designed for
radio.
Frank Sinatra? You know,
yeah.
I mean,
I just feel like the Academy is such a unique organization, and I think it's really important that it does reward the technicians, because I just don't want to see a brain drain that it causes us to not be able to have the science matching the art as we move forward.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, I totally agree with that, and the thing is that the technology of movie making has become really, it makes your brain hurt to think about it sometimes. I mean, it's so complicated. And, you know, you have, on the one hand, like this year, for example, we're looking forward to honoring the Micromir projection system, the DLP. I mean, it's just unbelievable technology. I mean,
yeah,
like millions of mirrors flopping around repeatedly.
If you drew it on the whiteboard, you'd say, well, that'd never work.
I mean, it's like, you know, nanotechnology, you know. Anyway, that's a really amazing thing. And it's true. I mean, the Academy, I call the Academy the Vatican of the movie industry. I mean, it kind of is. I mean, it's and the movie industry is very fortunate to have the Academy, which is self-funded through the show. I mean, we make a fortune every year. And so the Academy is like a very wealthy nonprofit, and so we do a lot of things. And one of the things is the technology. I mean, we over 10 years ago now we resuscitated the technology committee, the SciTech council. And so the SciTech Council deals with digital archiving problems and some of these things that face the industry that all the studios are concerned with. And so it's sort of like the 1930s over again. I mean, it's like the last time something this groundbreaking happened to the business was when sound came in.
Right.
You know. So...
Yeah. Well, look, to take nothing away from the ASC, which is also a terrific organization.
The ASC has actually been very valuable as well.
Plus, they have a great clubhouse.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But the work of the Academy overall is tremendous. And your contribution to it has been acknowledged by the Academy, and rightfully so.
Well, I'm glad to be here to do that. And I mean, it's been a love of my life, you know.
Well, it's been the joy of my visit to be able to sit and talk to you, sir. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.